From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, from the U.S. perspective, North Korea is an existential threat, a hostile nation, dangerously deluded, and ready for war. What's the North Korean perspective? A rare interview with the other side. It's Thursday, October 12th. Nicholas Kristof, just to start, how do you even get into North Korea? How did that work?
So I've been twice before, and each time afterward, I was banned for a while. I had last been in 2005, and so I had tried periodically to get visas again, especially in the last 5 years, and wasn't getting anywhere. And then a year ago, there was a new ambassador to the United Nations. Mm-hmm. I pushed quite hard, invested some effort in negotiating with North Korean diplomats, and also, of course, negotiating with another crucial party, my wife.
Who may have feared that this was not the wisest
idea. You know, look, if your wife is encouraging you to go to North Korea, then that's not a good sign either. So it finally came through. We initially were going to go in early September, and then they told us those dates would not work and gave us new dates at the very end of September.
Make sure I heard this right. Did you say it took 5 years, essentially, of negotiations to get into North Korea?
Yeah, that's about right.
That's extraordinary.
I have a long history with North Korean officials, and so they know my work, and they're very respectful, but I think they believe that I overemphasize human rights, and I think they think I don't fabricate things and am accurate, which they like, but I think they also believe I vastly exaggerate the importance of human rights issues.
So you have a strong sense that North Korea knows exactly who you are, and they're vetting your work, and they're making a determination about whether you, Nick Kristof, should never be allowed to come back.
Yeah, exactly. I've known many of the officials in the Americas Department of the Foreign Ministry for years, mm-hmm. and the Foreign Ministry seems to be in a bit of an outreach effort these days. They've invited some other journalists, some scholars, and I think that they are concerned that we may be on a path toward war and are seeing if they can build some unofficial channels back and forth with the U.S. So I think that was part of how I came to go to Pyongyang.
So you may be part of the diplomacy on the North Korean end is what you're saying.
Yeah. So in China in 1971, you had ping pong diplomacy that helped deal with the fact that you weren't having official government-to-government contacts
to
the same degree.
Athletes, ping pong players.
Exactly. Going to Beijing to break the ice. And these days, there aren't substantial contacts between the U.S. government and the North Korean government. And I think the North Korean officials think that, well, maybe journalists can help play some role.
And just the logistics of getting there, you have your visa. Then what? I mean, what's the route that you take? What's the flight?
You don't actually get a visa until the last minute. So you're approved for a visa, and then you have to fly to Beijing. These days, there's a United States ban on Americans going to North Korea, and so that complicates it as well. So we needed State Department approval. We needed an exception from the law, which can be given for journalistic purposes, and the State Department approved that very quickly. But they needed to give us a separate passport that would be good for one trip to North Korea. So flew to Beijing, where we received our piece of paper that was a North Korean visa. And then there's about one flight a day on an old Russian airliner from Beijing to Pyongyang, the North Korean capital.
So, Nick, you're in this Russian-made plane flying from Beijing. What do you notice from the air?
So you really don't notice anything tremendously different, you know, fields and forests. What you do notice is that in the plane, everybody around you is wearing a button showing a photo of either the founder of the country, Kim Il-sung, or his son, Kim Jong-il. And they're playing a propaganda loop on the television screen that shows
So instead of the United ad or whatever.
Exactly. It's a military concert with really wonderful classical music, but missiles periodically going off in the background.
Wow.
And so that was just a really eerie welcome.
And once you're on the ground, logistically, what do you go through in terms of security and getting out into the streets?
So at Pyongyang Airport, there are a series of immigration controls and they are clearly a little surprised to see an American passport, and they look at you, you know, very sternly. And then you go through customs where they go through everything you have.
And what did that look like?
So they had me take everything out of my my rollerboard and everything out of my, you know, shoulder bag. They wanted to see what everything was used for. They wanted to look in particular at books and written materials that I had. And, of course, I was very careful not to bring in books about North Korea, this kind of thing. But I was working on a column about endocrine disrupting chemicals. So I had a lot of obscure publications, right, about environmental chemistry. And so they looked through those very carefully. They looked through my phone and wanted to see what iMovies I had on it and what photos
I had. Oh, they're going into
on
apps and lists?
Yes.
And
I think what they were looking for is if I had stored any maybe religious or counter-revolutionary material, so to speak, on my phone that I would then disseminate. And the customs person went through my photos and saw this suspicious-looking Asian woman repeatedly in my photos, mm-hmm, and clearly thought this was some kind of a South Korean, you know, intelligence controller for,
right,
me or something, and said, you know, who's this? And I said, my wife. And she was very deflated, this customs officer. She just said, oh, she's very pretty. It was kind of a rare sort of human moment.
So when you set off into Pyongyang from your hotel, describe to me a little bit of what you see.
So Pyongyang is one of these classic communist capitals with huge wide streets, these vast monumental buildings, and almost no traffic. There are some taxis, which I had not seen on previous visits, and they are serving North Korean clientele. They're cruising around, so they have a certain amount of gas. But, you know, the city scene is just kind of eerie. We go by the huge mausoleum for Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, and all the cars slow down as they pass the mausoleum as a sign of respect. And there are periodic parades of middle school students or high school students, often in military uniforms, you know, trying to, I guess, build courage for the coming war with the U.S., which they anticipate. Likewise, there are a bunch of workers who are out kind of cheering people on to work hard and to prepare for war with the U.S. And then you have these billboards. I say the most common theme is missiles striking the U.S. Capitol, and often the flag is in tatters. There is one that shows a North Korean fist smashing down on U.S. missiles. There's another showing a truck with missiles, and it says that the U.S. is now in our crosshairs. There's one of a Korean soldier stomping on the head of this craven-looking American soldier with a U.S. on his helmet.
I mean, it sounds like the whole city exists visually in opposition to and as a threat to the United States.
Yeah, and I mean, look, North Korea has always been big on propaganda and propaganda scenes, but, you know, the level of hostility to the U.S. and the degree to which this has emerged as a theme is different from the way it was before. There's much more menace in the air.
So, Nick, where were you staying?
You know, you don't just book a hotel or something. So the foreign ministry, they were hosting us. They had arranged our accommodation. And they had put us in a guarded foreign ministry compound outside Pyongyang among the rice paddies. And this was kind of weird because in the past, I'd been able to stay in hotels right in Pyongyang. And at first, I thought this was simply to isolate us from North Koreans we might talk to. But gradually, it became apparent that, no, they essentially wanted to protect us from intelligence agencies or the military or people who might not be on board with this kind of outreach to American journalists.
I want to be sure I understand this. You've arrived in North Korea. Your guides are from the foreign ministry, which sounds like the U.S. equivalent of the State Department.
Right.
It feels like they may have been afraid of another division of the North Korea's government that might not have wanted you there. This is a pretty remarkable situation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'd gotten sort of hints of this on past visits, but the divide seemed much starker this time between foreign ministry people who are essentially pro-engagement and understand the stakes of just how awful a war might be.
With the United States.
With the United States and hardliners in the security apparatus and the military who think that these foreign ministry diplomats are wimps, hanging out too much with Westerners. They're soft. It's a dynamic you see in a number of countries, but it was very evident to me in North Korea.
So now we are in front of the gate behind here.
So can you tell me about one of your early stops in this trip?
Well, there is a new military museum that Kim Jong-un built to train people in sort of official ideology.
There's a monument to Victorious Fatherland Liberation War.
So we went to this war museum. It's this vast, sprawling plaza.
So here are some of the weapons captured from the U.S. imperialists during the war.
They have all this captured American military gear from the Korean War.
Mm-hmm. Are you getting more visitors now than usual? Is there any difference? Because there are tensions, is there any difference?
No difference
from a year ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So every day, about 3,000 people visiting our museum.
My tour guide was a young woman, quite charming. She spoke some English. She was a military officer.
Of course, I don't want the war. But if the U.S. imperialists invaded us and destroyed our country, I will also did all my life, all my thing, to defend my fatherland.
And her job was to lead people around, including foreigners, and to give them the official propaganda.
Yeah, and is that the museum? No more pictures.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Okay.
Great.
Oh, okay.
No,
and in the museum itself, they have a hall labeled the Defeat of the U.S. They have another about American atrocities against Koreans. And, you know, it's true that there genuinely were some American atrocities against Koreans during the war. There were also North Korean atrocities. There were plenty of atrocities to go around. But they argue that there was biological warfare against Koreans by the Americans, and that it's pretty clear now is a hoax, that that was concocted as propaganda. One of the scenes that just I found kind of saddest was a big diorama showing American corpses being eaten by crows with these, you know, cawing of crows in the background.
Did you feel you were being courted by them? Were they trying to impress you? Were they trying to make sure you had a good time?
I think the North Koreans wanted us to be welcome, but their focus was really on security. And they were repeatedly saying, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. We did ask to see examples of economic reform, which is underway. It's a specialty of Kim Jong-un. So they did take us to a dolphin show, for example. A pretty
like
good dolphin show.
Like a SeaWorld style?
Exactly. It was kind of a North Korean version of SeaWorld. And it involved people letting their hair down and yelping with excitement. And then it ended with this huge scenes on big screens of missiles shooting up. Rather than dolphins jumping.
So you got to have a lengthy conversation with a senior foreign policy official in North Korea, Mr. Che.
Do you want to sit in
this chair? Is that okay if you sit there?
It looks like a stage.
Who is he?
So Mr. Che is the deputy director of the Americas division in the foreign ministry. And I think he's fundamentally one of the more reasonable guys. He's smart. He's very well informed about American affairs. But in our conversation, he took a pretty tough line.
And what was the line that he took?
So on American detainees, including Otto Warmbier, he argued
that's
that
a student who was
– this is the University of Virginia student who stole a poster, ended up in a coma in North Korea and dying shortly afterward. And in the past at times when North Korea has done things like this, it has been willing to express regret.
Mm-hmm.
And this time there is no – such statement of regret. There is no hint of regret. What really rubbed me the wrong way was that they boasted about how much money they had spent on his treatment and how well they had cared for him after he was in a coma, how we didn't have any bed sores.
Here's a healthy young man who visits the DPRK, commits a crime, and ends up in a coma, in a vegetative state. On your watch.
I must say that irritated me to have a kid who's dead and to be boasting that, well, he didn't get bed sores.
How can Americans think of that and not feel some kind of deep resentment about the country that arrested him and imprisoned him, didn't let his family visit him, didn't let the Swedish ambassador have consular access to him? And the North Koreans pushed back very hard. They didn't give an inch of ground on that. And in fact, they accused the U.S. essentially of either killing him or allowing him to die simply to make them look bad.
The man you're talking to is a foreign policy official at a pretty senior level. So did you expect and did you maybe even hope that this would be one of the kind of great hopes for diplomatic breakthrough and dialogue? And what was the reality of that conversation?
If anybody in North Korea was going to be sympathetic to notions of dialogue and conciliation and talks about talks, it would be people like Mr. Che. And in fact, he was pretty tough.
So just to clarify, so unless the U.S. were to fundamentally change its policy toward North Korea, you don't see any point in further dialogue and discussions?
He was tough in saying that there is no reason for dialogue now because Trump is denouncing us. The basic message was we are on the brink of a nuclear war, and this war is not only survivable, but we will win it. And you push us, and your country is going to be ashes. And you've got to accept the fact that we are a nuclear power just as much as every other country.
Mr. Che, you spoke of us being on the brink of another nuclear war in the Korean Peninsula. Do you really think that North Korea can survive if there is such a nuclear war?
No.
So finally, Nick, if part of the trip was to have these diplomatic conversations, like the one with Mr. Che, that North Korean and U.S. diplomats aren't having, do you think you were successful?
This was a different North Korea than the ones I'd been to before. I was not nervous about going to North Korea previously. At this time, there was a menace in the air. There were these billboards showing the destruction of the U.S. There was much more rhetoric about the U.S. as the enemy. There was much more rhetoric about how war is imminent, not just a war, but a nuclear war. And I left feeling that there is a real risk of a war that would be just catastrophic and that we may be headed for miscalculations on both sides that make a war not likely but a significant possibility. But this would be a war that would be incomparably worse than the Iraq War or the Vietnam War because we are escalating in ways that create a cycle of escalation, and we are creating risks of accidents that could just spin out of control. And so I left deeply sobered and alarmed, and I think we are way too complacent about a risk of a cataclysmic war ahead.
Nick, thank you very much.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
We'll be right back. Here's what else you need to know today. President Trump has threatened to use the federal government's power over TV licenses to target NBC after a report it aired on Wednesday.
This morning, NBC News has learned striking new details about a July 20th meeting at the Pentagon that preceded Secretary of State Rex Tillerson calling the president a moron.
The story reported that in the July meeting, President Trump said he wanted to increase the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile to 10 times its current size, stunning some members of his national security team. It was after this meeting that Tillerson reportedly made his now infamous comment about Trump. Speaking from the Oval Office hours later, Trump denied the report.
It's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write, and people should look into it. No, I want to have absolutely perfectly maintained, which we are in the process of doing, nuclear force. But when they said, I want 10 times what we have right now, it's totally unnecessary, believe me, because I know what we have right now.
In a tweet, the president went further. With all the fake news coming out of NBC and the networks, he wrote, at what point is it appropriate to challenge their license? Bad for country. And the Boy Scouts of America says it will accept girls in a historic shift for the century-old group. I've seen nothing that develops leadership skills and discipline like this organization, said the president of the Boy Scouts. It is time to make these outstanding leadership development programs available to girls. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.